ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। श्रीमद् भागवतम कांड 8, chapter 11, texts 9 to 12, translation and commentary, by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. I'll read the Sanskrit and the translation of these verses, and only when we get to text 12 is there a purport, which I'll also read, Krishna willing. Navayam manyamananam atmanam tatra sadhanam girova sadhu sojanang grihnimo marmataranaha. You demigods, this is Vritrasura speaking. You demigods think that your own selves are the cause of your attaining fame and victory because of your ignorance, saintly persons. Bali Maharaj speaking. Because of your own ignorance, saintly persons feel sorry for you. Therefore, although your words afflict the heart, we do not accept them. Yeah, two cantos out here. Vritra's in the sixth canto. Text 10. Sri Shuka Uvacha. Ityakshipya vibhum viro nara chaivari. Naiva chaiva varindanaha akarna purnair ahan adakshay pyarahatang punaha akshepair ahatang punaha. Shukadev Goswami said, after thus rebuking Indra, king of heaven, with sharp words, Bali Maharaj, who could subdue any other hero, drew back to his ear the arrows known as Narachas and attacked Indra with these arrows. Then he again chastised Indra with strong words. I seem to remember looking this up at one time and found out that Naracha is a kind of arrow with a semicircular head. It's not with a pointed tip exactly, but with a sharp semicircular tip. There must be some other word for that. Head of the arrow, tip of the arrow. Evaṁ nirākṛto devo vairinā tatyavādinā nāṁ riṣyat tad atikṣepam tutrāhata iva dvipaha. Since Bali Maharaj, his rebukes were truthful, King Indra did not at all become sorry, just as an elephant beaten by its driver's rod does not become agitated. Praharat kulisham tasma amokhang paramardanaha sayano niyapatad bhumo chinna paksha ivachalaha. When Indra, the defeater of enemies, released his infallible thunderbolt scepter at Bali Maharaj with a desire to kill him, Bali Maharaj indeed fell to the ground with his airplane like a mountain with its wings cut off. Purport, in many descriptions in Vedic literature, it is found that mountains also fly in the sky with wings. When such mountains are dead, they fall to the ground where they stay as very large dead bodies. Om jnana timirandhasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurin militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha nama shreshtam manum api shachiputra matra swarupam rupam tasyagrajamurupurim maturim goshtavatim radha kundam girivaramaho radhika madhavasham prapto yasya pratita kripaya shri gurum tam natosmi Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Atav Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavangscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitam. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Might seem surprising that there's no commentary given for the ninth verse. You demigods think that your own selves are the cause of your attaining fame and victory. Because of your ignorance, saintly persons feel sorry for you. Therefore, although your words afflict the heart, we do not accept them. There's a lot of important instruction in there. Of course, it's repeated instruction. It's been seen in other parts of the Bhagavatam. And the first statement is obviously very close to the statement of Lord Krishna in chapter 3, text 27 of the Bhagavad Gita, Prakriti Kriyamanai Nai Gunai Karmani Sarvashaha Ahankara Vimurhatma Kartaham Iti Manyate. Persons who are bewildered by the three modes of material nature foolishly think themselves to be the doer of activities which are actually enacted by that material nature. Presumably the previous acharyas didn't give any comment on this, and therefore Srila Prabhupada hasn't. Also, another interesting philosophical or psychological or didactic point in text 11, that Bali Maharaj's rebukes were truthful. Indra accepted, yeah, we're foolish. Bali Maharaj was verbally chastising Indra and the demigods as being foolish. So Bali Maharaj is taking the moral high ground here. In one sense, he could do, because he had, according to Kshatriya Dharma, he had conquered the heavenly planets in a proper way. He had attacked, and the demigods had run away. He had all right to rule the heavenly planets. Of course, Indra had all right to make a counterattack also. And so things go on, back and forward. Deva-asura yuddha, fight between the demigods and the demons. And it's going on, and it will go on. I heard many years ago, I don't know any Shastric or Acharya statement to support it, but as a general statement, if we study the Puranas and Mahabharata and Ramayana, the Itihas and Puranas, Itihasas and Puranas, we can see there seems to be a lot of truth in it, that in the Satya Yuga, the demons and the demigods lived on different planets. In the Treta Yuga, they lived on the same planet. So we get Rama and Ravana on the same planet. Exactly what is a planet? Vedic cosmology? I won't get into that, because I don't know anyway. And then in the Dwarapa Yuga, they lived in the same family, and in Kali Yuga, in the same person. Which those of us who are trying to be Krishna conscious may have some experience of, that we're trying to be good, but Arjuna's query, what is that? Atakena prayuktin. What is that? Papam charati. Purushaha. Atakena prayuktena. Papam charati purushaha. Anichan apivarshnaya baladiva niyojita. Why do we want to be good, but we still do bad things, almost as if we're forced. Why is that? So it's not exactly that we have two people living in us, although it is a fairly common syndrome that people, they appear to be like that. They call it bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. In the Vedic understanding, you've got a ghost in there. Bhutagrasta. Someone's overtaken by a ghost who, from time to time, overtakes their personality. Or they may be totally overtaken, so you don't. They just appear to be totally like a demon. But when it's this, what we find in Kali Yuga is that there are many people who want to be good, but they succumb to their lower nature. And there are many instances in the Western world of prominent Christian preachers who fell shamefully from their position of respect and being seen as spiritual leaders due to having illicit sexual relations, the very thing which they're supposed to be standing against or standing as a symbol of morality. And within our ISKCON and within broader Vaishnav society, there have been not a few instances of this also. So what is the reason? Why does that happen? Well, I wouldn't like to say that everyone who falls down is insincere. They came to Krishna consciousness with good intentions, but baladiva niyojita. They're as if forced by their lower nature, trying to overcome their lower nature. And some may not succeed all at once, but they can go on. Prayatna yatamanas too. They can go on trying. It may be in another life even, but they'll go on trying. Anyway, the Srila Prabhupada didn't, and presumably the previous acharyas didn't comment directly on these verses. The commentary which is given here is very helpful for us who in the modern age are reading in Bhagavatam. In the Bhagavatam, the example, it's an example given to illustrate the point that Bali Maharaj fell to the ground with his airplane spectacularly. But instead of saying spectacularly, he means Vyasadeva employs an analogy. Like a mountain whose wings have been cut off and fell to the ground. Now that's not a very helpful analogy unless you understand it. Just like I was saying the other day, trying to explain what a jackfruit tastes like. It tastes something like sugarcane strained through a Muslim's beard. Sugarcane juice. Now someone who grew up in Clun in Shropshire, a minor village which most people living more than five miles away from probably never heard of. Clun in Shropshire in England, if you never heard of Shropshire. They probably never saw or heard of or tasted sugarcane juice. I didn't say London, because in London probably you can get it. And maybe they didn't see Muslims, or if they did, in Bengal, the Muslims generally they have long beards. So to a Bengali, growing up in traditional Bengal, or even in most parts of Bengal today, the analogy makes sense, although it doesn't make sense because it's a joke anyway. But to someone who has no experience of sugarcane juice or Muslims with long beards, it doesn't help at all. It doesn't help them to understand the point. So to say that Bali Maharaj fell down with his airplane like a mountain who's had his wings cut off. And remember, this is Indra who struck down Bali Maharaj, and it's generally Indra, one of his jobs as the king of heaven is to maintain universal order. So as we learn from Shastra, there used to be mountains flying around and then they'd settle down on the ground and crush everything underneath it. So to remove that difficulty, Indra went around and did a culling job or cropping job, cropping the wings off the mountains, and it seemed that they were killed by that. So it appears to the target audience, whoever that might have been, when this section of Bhagavatam was spoken, or in, at least in ancient, let's say in ancient times in India, that's vague enough. This analogy works. It's useless to give an analogy which doesn't work. It's like this. What does, if you say a difficult word, what does, use the word arcane, and then someone says, well, what does arcane mean? And you say, well, it means abstruse. Not exactly the same, but... And you give another difficult word. It doesn't help to explain it by giving another difficult word. So to make it clear for us, Srila Prabhupada explains, and he writes, in many descriptions in Vedic literature, it is found that mountains also fly in the sky with wings. When such mountains are dead, they fall to the ground where they stay as very large dead bodies. He doesn't, Srila Prabhupada doesn't attempt to justify it to someone who reading this, they think, I don't believe that. That can't be right. Well, already we've been through the fifth canto, and if you survived that, I guess you can get through to the eighth canto, and you can believe anything, right? If you believe that there are rivers of mango juice produced by huge mangoes dropping down from the ground, and Lord Shiva lives under a banyan tree, which is how 8 million yojanas wide and 8 million yojanas high, and the sun is on a chariot going around the earth, and the longer days and shorter days are caused by the moving at different speeds. And there are how many Valakilyas? 84,000 Valakilyas who go in. They go in front, facing backwards, praising the sun god. And if you can get through that, you can believe anything. But it would seem to our good intelligence that this is a lot of poppycock dreamed up by people in the past who really didn't know about. They didn't know any astronomy, they didn't know science, they didn't go to science classes, they didn't know any geology. We know from geology that mountains are not dead bodies that fall to the ground, but they're caused by seismic shifts, which force large quantities of molten matter. That's also pretty difficult to understand. If it's molten matter, how it should just flood out, isn't it? Exactly how does it work? When you get something as solid as granite, I mean, it's pretty solid. You have good experience from building this temple, building it with granite. It's pretty difficult to think how by squeezing it could go up. But anyway, I may not be properly presenting the geological explanation because I didn't study it very deeply. And there may be more than one also, because presumably, as in most areas of science, especially in theoretical science, there are different ideas, different theories. If you can't directly demonstrate it, just like, for instance, it's not very difficult to demonstrate that dihydrogen oxide, commonly known as water, is, after all, dihydrogen. It's a combination of hydrogen and oxygen. Because if you accept that the atmosphere, there's a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere, and you get some hydrogen and put a match to it, and you have it, do it all with chemical apparatus, and you capture the substance which is formed from that. It's a gaseous steam. And then it forms into water, and then you can test and see. It's water, okay, all right, so we accept that. But when it comes to things that it would be difficult to demonstrate it. We'll have a laboratory demonstration of how to make a mountain. Pretty hard. You'd have to have some pretty good bulldozers to do that, to bulldoze the land and to make it so the land goes up. So anyway, they have different theories. According to the geologists, whoever they may be, hunt them down and shoot them on sight. the geologists, the Himalayas are the youngest mountain range. They're a very young mountain range. They came into being relatively recently. What's the highest mountain in the world? Who can say? What did I hear? Everest? Is it Everest or K2? Huh? Everest. K2 is the most difficult to climb, is it? Well, if you take from top to bottom, it's under the sea. There you go. Stumped you all. Yeah, see, I know so many things. Okay, we know so many things, huh? The scientists have gone under the sea and found there are big mountains under there. Maybe when Indra cut off the wings, some of them fell into the sea. That would have caused a tsunami, right? Interestingly, talking about tsunamis, there is a phenomenon, there's a word for it, which I just can't remember in Sanskrit, which means subterranean, what's the word? Subaqueous volcanoes. Volcanoes within the ocean. So that you see a volcano comes out on the earth and spews all the lava. What if it comes up on the crust of the earth, presuming there is a crust of the earth, but according to geological theories, it comes up on the crust there. What if it comes in the sea? That's called it's a volcano in the sea. So there was knowledge definitely of astronomy in ancient India and throughout the world, actually. Otherwise, how did all these structures we find throughout the world that are geometrically made to be astronomically aligned to near to Glastonbury in England is very famous Stonehenge, which is astronomically aligned so that the sun shines through the main stones exactly at the summer solstice. That will probably change with the gradually moving orbit of the Earth, if we take the orbit of the Earth. But anyway, something's moving out there. Anyway, the point I'm making is that, or trying to make, as I'm going around in circles, is that certain things are taken as axiomatic within the Vedic culture, and they weren't questioned, even by very intelligent people. We find the commentators on the Bhagavatam, Madhvacharya, Vishwanath Chakravarti, they were highly intelligent people, no doubt about it. Even to know Sanskrit requires some good level of intelligence, especially if one is not raised as a child knowing that. So very philosophical people, but at the same time they accepted without questioning descriptions in Bhagavatam and other shastras, which don't correspond to anything within our immediate experience. We don't see Balakilyas, thumb-sized sages. We don't see such things as Sri Ram putting his foot on the stone and the stone reconverts into Ahalya. We don't see such things happening. Of course, in India, and in different parts of the world, there are yogis and shamans who do magic things. That is a fact. All over the world that has been. Things that defy common logic. It shouldn't happen. How can it happen? But it happens anyway. So there is an implicit acceptance that there are things that we can't understand according to our they don't happen according to the normal way things work. And also accepted that there is knowledge beyond our normal, humdrum way of life, the things that we see there. And the universe is highly variegated. And we tiny little beings, we don't know everything that's going on, and we accept the Shastric descriptions of various phenomena within the universe. And Buddhadev did also, and all his followers, they came up with some philosophy or group of philosophies. But they didn't question, although Buddhadev rejected the Vedas, but he never rejected the Puranic cosmology or anything else. Any other Puranic descriptions of what's going on in the world. And that was accepted. It was accepted if you do sinful activities, you go to hell. Hell is what? You are Yamaraj. So that it's implicitly accepted. You may say, well, there was no other worldview at the time. And then later we became more intelligent. But the Shastric description is that actually we're becoming less intelligent. Now that seems to be counterfactual, doesn't it? People previously, they didn't know about relativity theory or the laws of thermodynamics or quantum theory or string theory or any such thing. And they believed in rather outlandish ideas to explain what's going on. We know nowadays if there's rain, often at the end of a hot day, there's rain formed, and then we can understand that it's from some very basic meteorology, the heat makes the air rise, and it leaves a gap in which the heavier air, low pressure, and the low pressure causes the rain to fall. Oh, I don't know. I may very much simplify something like that, but it's a common pattern after a hot day. There's rain, and why the, and they can predict the weather. They say, you see, there's a trough of low pressure off the coast, and it's moving this way, and we predict in such and such a time there'll be rainfall off the coast of Bengal. And they did that recently. There's some typhoon Amphan, I think they call it. Was it? It would hit the cyclone. Was predicted, and it hit the Bay of Bengal. And it hit Bengal and Odisha. So that's very good, isn't it? They can predict such things. Of course, people used to be able to predict by other means also. Just like by seeing the movements of animals. Because certain animals, they have, or birds, they can understand what's going to happen, and if there's going to be a heavy rainfall, and they react in a certain way, and people who grow up in such a culture, they can see the birds are doing this, 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 it means there's going to be a heavy rainfall. I gave that example in that book, Glimpses of Traditional Indian Life. In a village, complete blue sky, complete sunshine, and very no sign of any rain, and then there's in the distance a deep grumbling of clouds. Rumbling. Well, there are no clouds to be seen. And one old man says, Bolte ame aschi, which means he says, I'm coming. And then within maybe 10 minutes, there's a furious rainfall. There's no sign, only that little sound of thunder in the distance. But he knows. Before an earthquake, they noticed in the Bay Area in California, pets like dogs, they run away from home. Animals, they leave the area. And they made some study. They can feel the shaking in the ground, and then they know there's going to be an earthquake. So then if your beloved pet dog runs away from home and you happen to live in San Francisco, maybe you should leave home too. Scientific. Well, people didn't know all the science, but they knew. Omens, the science of omens. Now we may say, well, very well known in India, throughout India, even today, is you say something, tick, 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 the lizard agrees. What does that mean? Then you take it for sure, that's confirmed, the lizard said. Now how can the lizard know what you're talking about? And how can the lizard know whether it's true or not? Okay. But it's accepted. And there are so many omens. If you see, we walk out of the house and you see someone carrying two full buckets of water, it's a good omen. Why should that be? What's the relationship between the bucket of water and something auspicious and favorable happening? You won't find by science. Maybe if you study enough cases of it, you'll do it. And maybe you could arrange for people to have beasts hanging around, playing with their mobile or their phone and with buckets of water. And then when you see someone coming out of the house, hey, okay, get into action and pick up the buckets of water and run onto the road and make some study out of that. Maybe you could do that, but that would be cheating. You could do it maybe. But how does it work? It's unlikely that the scientists will ever find out, because it's based on an understanding that everything in the universe is related and there are higher powers up there who oversee everything. Maya dhyakshena prakritihi, Krishna says. Under my supervision, material nature is going on. Krishna oversees everything through his representatives, and he's given a system whereby people who know, they can understand things. They can understand things which are going to happen, or something's favorable, not favorable. They can understand from the movements of the stars, from various omens, or even just in nature, the animals and the birds run away from an area or fly away. The sound of thunder in the distance. It's set up by Krishna like that. There's another kind of science which the gross scientists won't accept, because they only believe in their system of science. And they're so arrogant about it that they won't even allow, for instance, they have in pretty much all over the world, there's this system of medicine, the allopathic system of medicine, based on research and experimentation. And they don't agree to accept other forms of medicine as being acceptable. Here in India, Ayurveda is still going on side by side with allopathic. And it used to be, even for many years, that people would prefer Ayurveda over allopathic. They had more faith in it. And still today, many people. And we find even the doctors who are trained in Western medicine here in India, they often say that, oh, you have a stomach ache. Oh, they may not say take a pill, they'll say take some yogurt. That's not even, well, it's hardly even Ayurveda. You don't need to be an Ayurvedic doctor to know that, because everyone knows it, or it used to be. And so many things. And it's come into Western medicine also. They're just like people, even the doctors may recommend you do some meditation or some yoga to calm down, or you need to do some exercise, and this and so many things. Whereas it used to be, they never recommend anyone to do anything. They didn't even know the link between exercise and good health. Can you imagine? So dull, so dumb-brained. And if you want to get into researching all these things, it's a big area, because allopathy rests on the assumption that it's good health, bad health. It largely depends on chemical interactions within the body. Whereas in Ayurveda, the good health and bad health, it all depends on the balance of the three doshas. Kapha, Pitta, Vayu. It's a completely different outlook. And in Chinese traditional medicine, which also works in acupuncture, the description is there in the Vedic literature also, of the nadis, but the energy points, the energy channels, and if the channels get blocked, then it causes disease. It's actually not such knowledge is there, particularly in study of yoga. Kundalini yoga is based on the chakras and the nadis. But in Chinese medicine, they emphasize that very much. Whereas in Ayurveda, there's a different emphasis. But the very fact that these systems of medicine work within their own context, they may not work as well as previously. Just for instance, in Kali Yuga, everything's deteriorating, so the power of herbs is also deteriorating. The earth, the health of the earth is deteriorating, so the power of the herbs is deteriorating. The abilities of the doctors are deteriorating. So overall, Ayurveda, we may not get the same results as previously, and they say it doesn't work. But it's still accepted as and many people, actually from all over the world, they like Ayurveda, even though it's generally a slow treatment. Of course, if you have cold and your nostrils are all blocked up and got a lot of mucus inside the body, then you're on a long-term cure for that. You can get some short-term cure from Ayurveda. Talisadi Churna, it's an expectorant. It brings out the mucus, helps to bring out the mucus. But then, once you get over the immediate thing, and then, well, why are you getting coughs and colds every month? Then maybe you should see a doctor. But he may not give medicine. He may just say, adjust your diet according to your bodily type, and then according to the season. There's ritachar, and according to the season, you should, in the winter, you shouldn't take yogurt, for instance. I don't know if they follow in Tamil Nadu, because in a lot of Tamil Nadu there's no real winters per se, but definitely there is in North India. So certain foods are very good for the hot season, certain foods are very good for the cold season. Times of day, in the morning, you should take such and such a food. And it may vary from person to person also. So they may not even give medicine, and it may not be very profitable. Especially if you charge inflated prices for the medicine, and then the whole Hippocratic Oath becomes hypocrisy. The Hippocratic Oath that doctors are supposed to take, that you're going to act for the benefit of the patients, and it's a noble profession, but people go into medicine because they make a lot of money. And make a lot of money means you cheat people and exploit people. You get employed in a hospital. A private hospital means run as a business, and they tell the doctors you have to have a minimum number of operations in the month, otherwise you don't get your bonus. And so they recommend operations to people who don't need them. Bogus, meaningless operations, because they have to make money for the hospital. And so many bogus things come in. Anyway, the point I'm saying here is that it's a very big discussion, but there is, and many, many people all over the world accept this now, that there is knowledge in the ancient world. A lot of it's been lost, a lot of it's been destroyed. A lot of the ancient knowledge of India was destroyed by members of a certain minority community who came into India, and one of their favorite activities was killing people, especially brahmanas, and who had the knowledge. Not all of it was, a lot of it wasn't written down. Destroying temples, burning libraries, huge library at Nalanda and Takshashila, burned as a great contribution to the enrichment and ennoblement of the human race. In Constantinople also, when it was taken over by a member of the same minority community, which is now the majority community there, one of their great contributions to humanity was destroying the greatest library of the known civilization at that time. So many things got lost, and the nature of Kali Yuga, things got lost. And the British, who were ruling India, they were more subtle, but they also destroyed so much knowledge by belittling it, so that and introducing a new kind of economic system, so that that knowledge you couldn't live by being a brahmana. And anyway, people thought it was stupid to pursue such knowledge. And the real one, what was it? This who said that? Macaulay. One shelf in any English library is worth more than all the Vedic literature put together. And this way they killed the respect that people had for Vedic knowledge. And so we find up to the present day there are so many libraries all over India of ancient manuscripts which are just deteriorating. No one cares for them. In Vrindavan, it may be in the winter, someone will take out the old manuscripts and burn them to warm their butt in the cold season. Fortunately, Srila Prabhupada brought the essence of all knowledge, the Srimad Bhagavatam, and made it available. And by its mass distribution of these books, it's unlikely it's going to get lost very soon. That's one very good way of distributing, of preserving knowledge, is to distribute it. If only one person knows that knowledge, then it dies with that person. Of course, knowledge is never really fully lost, because there's Krishna, who is eternal, and he can inspire someone else to know it. And that happens regularly. The Vedic knowledge is lost, and then Krishna inspires someone. It's revealed in this way to different rishis. Especially at the beginning, Tene Brahma Hridaya Adi Kaviya, Krishna reveals it to Brahma, who then teaches it to his various followers. So knowledge is never fully lost, but the essence is here. One of Srila Prabhupada's godbrothers, Bhakti Pramod Puri Maharaj, said that one verse, if all in the Vedic knowledge was lost, everything except one verse, then the whole Vedic knowledge could be reconstructed from that. What is that? It's actually in Bengali. It's from Chaitanya Charitamrita. Atendriya priti vancha tare bale kam krishnendriya priti icha dhare premanam. They're acting for one's own sensual gratification is called kam. It's a definition. It's a definition of two terms. And acting for Krishna's sense gratification is called prema, love. So that's really the essence. And you may quibble whether mountains used to have wings and they would fall down. You may quibble over that. And you may say it's not so important. But actually it is important to accept this also. It is important because it is part of the corpus of Vedic knowledge. If we don't accept that, then what happens to Krishna Leela? Govardhan was also a movable mountain, right? Govardhan wasn't flying, but was carried by one rishi, whose name I don't remember, who put him down, and he didn't get up again. And he was talking mountain, with his father, And then what happens to Krishna Leela, lifting Govardhan? Well, that's not possible either. Well, that's the whole fun, isn't it? That Krishna lifts a mountain. Who else lifts a mountain?
I don't believe in that.
And then you're an atheist. God can do anything. Lifting a mountain, anyway, he holds all the mountains by his own sweet will. All the mountains, all the oceans, all the continents, all the planets. If at all we accept Krishna as God, we have to accept he lifts a mountain. And why does he do that? To protect the inhabitants of Vrindavan. But there are so many other reasons. The inhabitants of Vrindavan, they can just be with Krishna for 7 days. Thank you, Indra, for sending the rain. Now we can, but as a result, we're with Krishna for 7 days. And the young gopis, we're allowed to look at him. We're not allowed to otherwise. We have an excuse. We can look at him. they weren't, the inhabitants of Vrindavan, they weren't so much, oh, he's holding a mountain. They forgot about their looking, ah, his beautiful face, his beautiful limbs, beautiful form, everything beautiful, beautiful eyes. Oh, and he's holding a mountain. Oh, that they weren't overcome by the fact that he was holding a mountain, but his beauty. But there was one major thing missing for 7 days. I don't think he was playing a flute during that time. We don't know. But then he used to play the flute to call his cows and his gopis, and they were there with him anyway, so he didn't need to. Maybe some of the other cowherd boys, they'd play their flute. They all had flutes also. All the cowherd boys have flutes. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Vancha kalpataru bhyascha kripa sindhu bhyavacha patita nam pavane bhyo vaishnavi bhyo namo.
His Holiness Bhaktivikas Swami Maharaj ki jai.